Imagine your daily routine involves like opening a browser, typing in a set of credentials, navigating through a really complex checkout flow, right? And then verifying a database entry, and then doing the exact same thing 500 more times across Chromium, Firefox, and WebKit.
Sounds awful.
It is. If you are in software engineering, you know that manual regression testing is essentially, well, it's a digital groundhog day.
Oh, absolutely. It's soul crushing.
Exactly. To escape that loop, engineering teams have aggressively migrated toward automated solutions. So today, we are doing a deep dive into mastering modern web automation.
Yeah, and specifically, we're extracting the core architecture from Playwright Master's Ultimate Playwright Interview Questions Guide for the year 2026.
Which is such a comprehensive resource for SDTs and engineers. We're bypassing the basic syntax tutorials today.
Yeah.
You know, and going straight to the underlying mechanics of how this framework actually controls the browser. Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah, this guide offers us a fascinating look into the architectural decisions that really made Playwright the industry standard.
Because it wasn't always the standard, right?
Right. Right. When we talk about bypassing that manual regression loop, we have to look at how Playwright handles the browser engine itself. It doesn't rely on standard WebDriver protocols like the legacy systems did.
Which were always so clunky.
Super clunky. Playwright communicates directly with the browser via the Chrome DevTools protocol, or CDP.
Hi, CDP.
Yeah, which gives it this bidirectional communication. I mean, it's not just sending commands blindly. It's actually listening to network events and DOM mutations in real time.
That structural difference, I think, is where the huge performance gains come from.
Mm-hmm.
The source material emphasizes cross-browser capabilities, obviously. But what really caught my attention is how Playwright handles the Apple ecosystem.
Oh, yeah. The WebKit implementation?
Right.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't actually interact with the branded Safari app sitting in your macOS dock app.
No, not at all. Instead, Microsoft built their own implementation of WebKit, which is the engine-powering Safari, and Playwright talks directly to that engine.
Which is just wild to me.
It's brilliant, though. By bundling its own WebKit and Firefox binaries, Playwright guarantees a hermetic environment. You aren't subject to the random quirks or, you know, user extensions.
Those weird browser extensions people install.
Exactly. Or background updates of a consumer-level browser application.
Yeah.
You are testing against the pure rendering engine.
And why should you, the listener, care about that? Well, this level of environmental control is critical when you start running massive test suites, right? Where a tiny bit of flakiness can cost a team hours of debugging.
Absolutely. Which honestly brings us right into the most persistent bottleneck in automation, which is the shared state problem.
Oh, the shared state problem. Yeah, explain that a bit.
So if you need to run, say, 50 end-to-end tests concurrently, you run into collision issues. Test A is trying to log into a staging environment and writes an auth token to local storage.
Okay.
But then milliseconds later, test B, which is maybe testing a guest checkout flow, reads that exact same token, assumes it's logged in, and boom, the test fails.
Right, because they're crashing into each other. And older frameworks forced you to run these sequentially, right?
Yeah, one by one, which totally bottlenecked deployment pipelines. Or, and this was almost worse, you had to write complex teardown scripts to wipe the database and clear the browser cache after every single assertion.
It sounds incredibly inefficient.
It was. But Playwright solves this through what we can call an architecture of isolation. The hierarchy laid out in the guide is strict. First, you have the browser, then the browser context, and then the page.
Okay, so the browser is just the underlying engine instance, like the Chromium executable itself.
Right.
But that middle layer, the browser context,
yeah,
that's where the actual magic, the isolation happens.
Exactly. Think of a browser context as an entirely ephemeral incognito profile.
Like a brand new user.
Totally fresh. It maintains its own isolated cookies, its own local storage, and its own cache memory. Context A literally cannot access the network cache or the service workers of context B. So when you instantiate a page, which just represents your active tab, it operates strictly within the boundaries of that specific context.
Okay, wait. I want to push back on the necessity of that middle layer for a second.
Sure.
If total isolation is the goal for concurrent execution, why not just launch 50 completely independent Chromium processes? Why bother managing these isolated contexts within a single browser instance?
That's a great question, actually. It really comes down to raw computational overhead. Booting a full Chromium process is heavy.
Because it's an entire browser.
Right. It requires significant CPU cycles to initialize the rendering engine, boot up the JavaScript V8 engine, allocate base memory, all of that. If your CI worker tries to spin up 50 distinct Chromium processes simultaneously, you will trigger severe CPU throttling.
And your test suite will just crawl to a halt.
Exactly. It'll freeze.
Ah, so it's akin to containerization, like Docker. Instead of spinning up 50 full virtual machines with their own heavy operating systems, you spin up one host of the browser and run 50 lightweight, isolated containers the context inside it.
That is a highly accurate way to visualize it, yeah. They share the underlying engine process, but totally isolate the session state. Contexts take just milliseconds to create, and they consume a fraction of the memory.
So you get the strict data isolation of 50 separate browsers, but with a footprint light enough to allow true parallel execution on a single worker node.
Exactly.
Okay, so now that we have these isolated, highly efficient environments set up, we have to look at how the code actually sees and navigates the web page. The guide goes out of its way to warn engineers against relying on raw CSS selectors or XPath to locate elements.
Yeah, it's a big shift.
And here's where it gets really interesting. We spent years training QA engineers to master complex XPath traversal, and now the leading framework is basically telling them to stop using it.
Because the modern front end has fundamentally changed, you know. When applications are built with React, Vue, or Angular, the DOM is highly dynamic.
Yeah.
Elements are constantly re-rendering. And utility-first CSS frameworks like Tailwind mean that class names change based on really subtle styling updates.
So if your locator depends on an element being, say, the third div under a specific container.
Right, and a developer wraps that button in a new formatting span.
Boom, your XPath fails.
Exactly. The UI looks identical to the human user, but the test crashes because the strict path changed.
Which makes the test suite incredibly brittle. You end up spending half your sprint updating locators just because the front-end team refactored a component.
It's a nightmare. So to fix this, Playwright pushes user-facing locators. Specifically, they prioritize get by role.
Okay, get by role.
Yeah. So instead of targeting a DOM node, you might write get by role, quote, button, and then specify the name as submit order.
It shifts the testing philosophy entirely. Get by role taps directly into the accessibility tree of the browser, doesn't it?
It does. It mimics how an actual human or an assistive technology, like a screen reader, experiences the page. It doesn't care about your nested divs or your dynamic CSS classes.
It just evaluates whether the element fundamentally functions as a button and exposes the text submit order to the user.
Exactly. As long as the semantic meaning and the visual outcome remain intact, the test passes, regardless of how messy the underlying code refactor was.
That is so powerful.
Yeah.
And interacting with those resilient locators brings up another huge concept: synchronization. Playwright's implementation of auto-weighting is the massive shift from legacy frameworks.
Yeah. Game changer.
Because we used to litter our scripts with hard-coded commands like wait for timeout 5000. Just forcing the thread to sleep for 5 seconds and praying the database query finished rendering to the UI in time.
And using a static timeout is, well, it's basically an admission of failure in automation.
Right.
You are guessing the latency. If the network is fast, you waste 4 seconds of idle compute time doing nothing. If the network is congested and it takes 6 seconds, your test fails falsely.
Using a static timeout is essentially using a recipe that tells you to bake a chicken for exactly 45 minutes, regardless of whether you're using an industrial convection oven or, like, a campfire.
That's a great analogy. It's totally blind.
Right. Whereas Playwright's auto-weighting operates more like a smart meat thermometer. It actively pulls the internal state of the food, or the DOM in this case, and only triggers the action when the specific conditions are actually met. But what are those specific conditions? The guide mentions actionability checks.
Right, the actionability checks. When you command Playwright to click that submit order button, it doesn't just blindly fire a click event at some XY coordinates. It executes a strict checklist.
Okay, what's on the checklist?
First, is the element actually attached to the DOM? Second, is it visible, meaning it isn't hidden by display none or zero opacity?
Makes sense.
Third, is it stable? Like, if there's a CSS transition sliding the button onto the screen, Playwright actually waits for the animation frame to stop.
Oh, wow. That stability check alone eliminates so much random flakiness.
It really does. But it goes further. It checks if the element can actually receive events, ensuring there isn't an invisible loading overlay sitting on top of it with a higher Z index.
Oh, I hate when that happens.
Right. And finally, it checks if the element is enabled. It continuously pulls these states under the hood, usually every few milliseconds. And the moment all 5 conditions resolve to true, it executes the click.
That level of internal polling is exactly why you just don't need static sleeps anymore.
Exactly.
But, you know, even with perfect synchronization and these brilliant locators, relying entirely on UI interactions to set up your test data is kind of an anti-pattern.
Yeah.
If we look at the API testing section of the guide, we see how engineers are using Playwright to bypass the UI entirely.
Yeah, if we connect this to the bigger picture, the real power here is blending the back end and the front end. The framework exposes an API request context.
Which means you can fire raw HTTP requests directly from your test script, utilizing the same network stack as the browser.
Right. When you are writing an end-to-end test for a user dashboard, you obviously need an authenticated user. Doing that through the UI requires loading the login page, typing the username, typing the password, clicking submit, waiting for the redirect.
That might take 4 seconds per test.
At least. Multiply that by 1,000 tests, and you've wasted over an hour of compute time just watching a robot log in.
So we inject the state instead. The guide breaks down how to use the API to post the credentials directly to the backend authentication endpoint, receive the session token or cookie in the JSON response, and then save that into a storage state file.
That storage state is the absolute key. Playwright serializes the cookies and the local storage payload into a simple JSON format. When you instantiate your browser context for the actual UI test, you just pass that JSON file as a configuration parameter.
And then what happens?
The context boots up, deserializes the data, and populates the browser's storage before the first page even loads.
So when the script navigates to the dashboard URL, the server reads that injected cookie, assumes the user has already gone through the UI login flow, and serves the authenticated page immediately.
Instantly. You shave those 4 seconds down to about 200 milliseconds.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
It fundamentally optimizes your pipeline. You still write one dedicated UI test to ensure the login screen visually works, obviously. But for the other 999 tests, you use API state injection.
Exactly. You authenticate once via API and never have to watch a robot type a password again.
Okay, so state injection is powerful for our own servers. But what about third-party dependencies? The guide dedicates a lot of space to network interception using the page.root method.
Yeah, this is a fun one.
It gives a scenario where you intercept a call to a third-party payment gateway, like Stripe, and deliberately mock a 500 internal server error. Now wait, I have to ask. If we intercept the network request before it even leaves the browser and force a failure response, aren't we falsifying the test results? How is faking a network failure actually useful?
That's a super common pushback. But you have to separate the domain's responsibility here. You are not writing tests to validate Stripe's internal infrastructure.
Right.
They have their own engineering teams for that. Your responsibility is testing how your front-end architecture reacts to external degradation.
Because external APIs will eventually go down.
Inevitably. It's just a matter of time. When that Stripe endpoint throws a 500 error, what happens to your application's state? Does your React component crash and throw an unhandled runtime exception, leaving the user staring at a blank white screen?
Which is the worst user experience.
Or does the submit button remain disabled indefinitely, trapping the user in a perpetual loading state?
Right. Or does the UI catch the failed promise, gracefully revert the cart state, and display a nice localized error message telling the user to try again later?
Precisely. That's what we want to test. By utilizing network interception, Playwright intercepts the outbound HTTP request based on a URL regex pattern. It prevents the request from hitting the actual wide area network and instead returns a predefined JSON payload and status code.
Okay, I get it now. You are deterministically simulating the worst case scenario to guarantee your error boundaries and recovery logic function as designed. And you do it without ever needing to coordinate with a third-party service outage.
Exactly.
That makes a lot of sense. You are bending the rules of the network layer to test the resilience of your UI components. So what does this all mean when we scale up?
Well, that's where the real challenge is.
Right, because we have robust locators, auto-waiting, mocked network responses. But any engineer running massive suites in a CI/CD pipeline knows that tests will still fail. And debugging those failures in a pipeline is notoriously difficult because they run in headless mode.
Yeah, and running headless meaning without the GUI rendering to a physical display is mandatory for CI performance. You just can't render all that visually on a server.
But when a test fails on a Linux Worker node in AWS, you can't visually see what went wrong. A text log outputting timeout error, element not visible, is, frankly, often useless.
Totally useless. Was the element obscured? Did the backend return a 404, preventing the component from rendering at all? You just don't know from a text log.
So to solve that black box problem, Playwright utilizes the Trace Viewer.
Yes, Trace Viewer.
The guide positions this as the ultimate debugging tool, and looking at the mechanics, it's far more sophisticated than just taking a video recording of the headless browser, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. This raises an important question about reliability, right? Video recordings are heavy, and worse, they don't allow you to inspect the DOM. The Trace Viewer actually captures a serialized snapshot of the DOM at every single action point.
Wow.
It's basically a time machine. And alongside that DOM snapshot, it captures a complete HAR, an HTTP archive, which logs all network requests, responses, and headers. It bundles the console logs, the executed source code, and action metadata into a single compressed zip file.
So when you download that trace file from your CI server and load it locally, you aren't just watching a flat playback. You are scrubbing through a reconstructed timeline of the browser's exact state.
Exactly. You can inspect the network tab as it existed milliseconds before the failure. You can pop open the DOM inspector and see the exact CSS styles that were applied to the element that Playwright couldn't click.
So you might discover that, like, an arbitrary z-index change caused a footer to overlay your submit button, but only on specific viewport sizes.
Right. It transforms pipeline debugging from a frustrating guessing game into targeted root cause analysis.
Which is incredible. And having those analytical tools is what allows teams to confidently execute tests at scale. Which brings us to the final major architectural concept in the guide, the difference between parallelism and sharding.
Yeah, these terms get thrown around interchangeably a lot, but they represent entirely different infrastructure strategies.
Break that down for us.
So they address two different bottlenecks. Parallelism, as we discussed earlier with browser contexts, handles execution concurrency on a single machine. You configure Playwright to run 5 or 10 test workers simultaneously on one CI node, but a single node is ultimately bound by its physical CPU cores and RAM. If you have a suite of 10,000 end-to-end tests, even highly optimized parallel execution on a single 16-core machine might take 2 hours.
Which is unacceptable for a modern continuous deployment pipeline where developers need immediate feedback on their pull requests.
Exactly. You can't wait 2 hours. That's where sharding comes into play. Sharding distributes the test suite across multiple separate physical or virtual machines.
Okay, so at the CI configuration level, you instruct Playwright to basically split the suite into fractions.
Right. You might spin up 20 parallel CI jobs, telling Job 1 to run shard 1 of 20, Job 2 to run shard 2 of 20, and so on.
And Playwright handles the math internally, dividing the test files evenly across the runners. So instead of one machine churning through 10,000 tests in 2 hours, you have 20 machines executing 500 tests each.
Exactly. You drop your pipeline execution time down from hours to maybe 6 minutes. You combine sharding across the cluster with parallelism on the individual nodes, and you achieve massive scalability.
It represents a maturation in how we approach quality engineering, doesn't it? We aren't just writing scripts anymore. We are managing distributed execution infrastructure, network manipulation, state injection.
Playwright has essentially consolidated the entire toolchain required to validate modern asynchronous web applications into a single cohesive framework.
It really is a masterclass in providing developers the exact levers they need to control the browser environment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, today we've traced the evolution from legacy sequential testing to Playwright's isolated browser contexts. We've seen how user-facing locators like Get Byroll and Dynamic Auto Waiting totally eliminate the brittleness of static timeouts in XPath.
Right, right.
We've broken down how injecting storage state and intercepting network traffic allows us to surgically test UI behavior without relying on back-end latency. And we've explored how the Trace Viewer and sharding empower teams to actually debug and scale those tests across cloud infrastructure.
The guide makes it very clear that mastering Playwright isn't just about learning syntax. It's about understanding how to manipulate browser architecture to guarantee application stability.
It absolutely is. But I want to leave you, our listener, with a final provocative thought to mull over. Throughout the source material, there are these subtle nods to the integration of AI within the testing ecosystem.
Oh, yeah. The AI course is mentioned at the end.
Right. Currently, Playwright gives us incredible control, but it still requires a human engineer to explicitly define the locators, manage the network mocks, and dictate the assertions. We still have to write get by role button submit. But as the industry pivots toward agentic AI systems capable of autonomous decision-making, the way we use frameworks like Playwright is going to shift radically.
It's going to be fascinating to watch.
Imagine a near-future pipeline where you don't write assertion scripts at all. You just provide an AI agent with a natural language prompt, like test the guest checkout flow for a user in Canada.
And it just does it.
Right. The agent dynamically spins up a Playwright browser context, traverses the DOM in real time, intercepts the necessary geofencing APIs on the fly, and adapts its own locators if the front-end team happened to change the layout that morning.
Wow.
It wouldn't just be automated testing. It would be autonomous, self-healing quality assurance using Playwright's CDP connection as its nervous system.
That changes everything.
It really does. The tools we use to explicitly control the browser today are basically building the foundation for AI agents to navigate the web for us tomorrow. So keep questioning how things work behind the screens, because the layer of abstraction is only going to get higher. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the mechanics of modern browser automation. Catch you next time.